No, we only want the sand.
Okay, good evening. I wanted to just firstly, I forgot to thank everybody for coming out last week. It was just so freezing, and I was kind of amazed everyone turned up, but I appreciate the effort that was made this evening. The weather's been a bit kinder. It's not so biting as it was. A couple of things I want to just mention, because I did not get to last week. In terms of books, over here, Mr. Golka has the art school, which I think is something I didn't mention last week. And again, a very wonderful translation and commentary, and certainly worthy of note. And you know, something that if it works for you, then that hopefully will be the one that you would look at. I'm still hooked on the Judaica, because he does a bit more than the art school does. In other words, although this is now 20 years ago that this book first came out, it is a bit more comprehensive in the way I see it than the article. Both of them are excellent, and certainly, you know, I don't have shares in either company, so whichever one you buy, and buy both if necessary. The other book I wanted to show you, because this is the one I mentioned last week, is Rav Ariel. He's a gentleman who lives in Israel, and he's in Midrashet HaGolan in Chispin. And this is a book called Oz V'Anava. And the reason why I like it, apart from the commentary, it's got nice pictures. But if you just see, for instance, when we get to, he hasn't got much on the beginning of the book, surprisingly, but he's got some great pictures here with the story of Devorah, Mount Tabor, if some of you may know, the big bump in the middle here, right? And this is the, when you go up to, we have family in Kibbutz Levi, so every time we go past Mount Tabor, you know, you always think of, at least I sometimes think of the story of Devorah and sister, and it's fabulous countryside. It's really a special place. So this is a book again which I do recommend. I always tell the students in Stern that this is the most Hebrew I've ever come across. And what I mean by that is that there is modern Hebrew, which is readable, and then there's modern Hebrew, which is not readable. And this one is very close to being not readable. It is very, the standard of it is very, very difficult. So it's not a book that I use a lot in terms of its commentary, although we will see one piece probably in the next couple of weeks on Ehud. He's got a very, very nice explanation about Ehud, which is something we'll come to. So again, I just wanted to sort of be a bit more direct about that. The final sefer, which I just didn't bring, but maybe I'll bring it next week, is something that if you go to the YU bookseller, you will find, and it is Da'at Sofrim. Da'at Sofrim is written by a rabbi called Reb Chaim Dov Rabinovich. Chaim Dov Rabinovich, I knew personally. I knew him for a number of years. The story goes like this. That in 1979, I went to live in Israel. And in 1980, I was working at Bank Mizrahi in Rehov Ben Yehuda. Some of you may know it. Okay, a wonderful bank, as all the banks are in Israel. And one of my clients sat down one day, after being, whatever it was, he was there for a number of months. And I knew Rabbi Rabinowitz from New York. You know, that was Rabbi Rabinowitz. There was about, how many Rabbi Rabinowitz is there in Israel? Probably hundreds of them, right? Or maybe, I don't know, a dozen at least. And in passing, he started shmoozing, and he said, by the way, have you ever come across the book that I spent a number of years trying to write this sefer. Have you ever come across it? So I asked him in passing, you know, what is the sefer called? So he said, Da'at Sofrim. And I said, Da'at Sofrim, the only Da'at Sofrim I know is 20 volumes on Tanakh. He said, that's it. He said, that's a book. He said, you know, I've been writing it for a number of years. I nearly fell off my chair. I have to tell you, I actually nearly passed out. Because there he is sitting there, a short guy, about 5 foot nothing, little Spitzbird, very wonderful, wonderful man of the, I think, originally from the Mitte, if I'm not mistaken, came from Lithuania. Remarkable sefer. I mean, wow. And he's sitting in front of you, and he's telling you about the sefer. And the only anecdote I remember so clearly from him is that whenever I wrote his name on a form, I had to write Chaim Dov. because there was a Chaim Rabinovitz who was a conservative rabbi in New York, and he did not want to be confused in any way with the other gentleman. So he said, write my name Chaim Dov Rabinovitz. And it was funny at the time, it was really very, very amusing. He did offer me a job, and I didn't take it because I just wasn't ready to do it, to actually start translating the book. And in subsequent years, it has been translated, and it's coming out now volume by volume. Again, I'm sure it's at the bookseller. There is a bit of an issue, apparently, in terms of the family involvement. I don't know what's going on there, but the safe, if you can handle the Hebrew is wonderful, and if you want to look at the English, it's now becoming available as well, after all those years. And he did pass away not so long ago, maybe 2 years ago. A very wonderful gentleman, lived in Rehavia, extraordinary. I mean, these are the guys you meet in Israel, right? Walking along the street, there he is, the author of a safe for 20 volumes on Tanakh. It just blows my mind. But there you go. So that's the other sefer called Dat Sofrim. So it's a sefer that, again, you may come across a blue cover in Hebrew and a sort of pink come yellow, sort of yellowish cover in English. Okay. Now, in terms of what we did last week, we started talking about an introduction, and we spoke about the difference between a shofet and a melech, a number of similarities, a number of differences, and the kids said the most, I think I have to say, the most striking difference that we came across was that the shofet was a one-shot deal. There was no concept of dynasty. When it came to melech, it was dynastic. Once you had David, or essentially once you had Shaul, although, again, that's a whole story by itself, how he forfeited the whole thing, the reality was that once you got the melech, you got the whole package forever and ever. And it wasn't something that you would, after the person passed away, you would say, thank God we got rid of that guy. You know, this is now the family would continue. And if you got Shlomo, then you ended up with Rechavam. Right? Shlomo was mind-blowing in so many ways. Rechavam was very, again, difficult act to follow. How do you follow a father like Shlomo? But in the circumstance, he made a bit of a chilling of the whole thing, as you probably know, and the split of the kingdom and everything that went on after that, and it was a pretty disastrous situation. With the Shofet, no dynastic concept whatsoever. And the other major difference, I think, which we have to emphasize, is that when it came to the Melech, he had rights over the people, which the Shofet did not have. The Melech could take the people he can conscript them into the army, take the girls into the palace to work in servitude or whatever, become ladies in waiting or whatever you would call it in whatever country you're in. And in terms of the Shofet, no such power existed. The Shofet, again, had powers of punishment, but he did not have powers of conscription or anything like that. So those are the two major differences, and I think it's important to appreciate that when we start learning, say, the Shofet, what a Shofet really is. What I asked you to do last week, and I hope some of you managed to do this, is to read the first two chapters. In fact, we have to read essentially 2.5 chapters. And I just want to make one or two comments on the Prokin, because we're not going to go through them line by line. But there are a number of issues here which are very interesting. If you open up the shops in Perek Aleph, you'll see that the classic beginning, Vayehi Achare, the Vayehi, there's a continuation here, the Vav. The Vav connects Shoftim to what's going on before. And you'll see in chapter 1, Perek Aleph, that it is a continuation. They are still conquering the land, and they are still trying to push out wherever they can push out. And Yehuda's, what did you say, this famous comment at the beginning, Yehuda Ya'aleh, right? Yehuda will go and lead the charge. Now there's no one person who can take over from Yoshua, so it becomes a tribal thing. The tribe of Yehuda was always going to be Lo Yosef Shevin Yehuda. They were the ones you're going to look up to, and they were the ones who are going to lead in terms of battle, etc. Now, what is very interesting, of course, is when you a number of references over here. The first reference I just want to point out is in Pasuk Yud Bet, Yud Gimel, 12 and 13, where you get the first mention of Otniel ben Kenaz. Otniel ben Kenaz was Achi Kalev, Hakaton Mimena. He was the younger brother of Kalev. So you'll say to me, wait a minute, Kalev is Kalev ben Yefuneh, right? So what's going on here? So it turns out that it was the same mother and different fathers. Presumably one of the husbands died and she remarried, and Odniel was born presumably of the second father, the same mother. So of course the mother's name is not mentioned, so we don't, I don't know if there's a midrashic source for who she is, but that's the story. So you've got Kalev, the famous Kalev from the stories of Hebron, etc., and this gentleman Odniel ben Kenaz. Now he comes through in Perek Aleph as a very, how should we say, a warrior sort of guy. He's the guy by Yilkadav, possibly in Gimel verse 13, by Yilkadav the Eben Kenaz. So the Eben Kenaz is the one who captures this place, which is called Kiryat Sefer. It's interesting, nowadays there is a Kiryat Sefer which become a very Haredi sort of town in right next to Chashmonaim. All these names keep repeating themselves. You'll see here names you'll recognize, Shalabim and places like that. You know, these names just are there from time immemorial. This is why one gets so upset what's going on at the Kotel at the moment. I don't want to go there. This whole battle of trying to prove that we have no claim on all the history of Eretz Yisrael is really, it's an offense, not just offensive, I think it's obscene, but the Israeli government doesn't seem to be able to sort of get that message across to the world. But that's a bit of politics, and I don't really want to go there. But anyway, we've got this thing, Odniel ben Kenaz, and he becomes over initially as a fighter. Now what we're going to see later on, and this is again what we spoke about last week, is that the Shofet has a double role, probably even more than a double role. One is a role of military leadership, and the second role, which is equally, probably more important, of spiritual leadership. So the Shofet is the guy who transmits the oral tradition from the previous generation through to the next leader, to the next generation. And basically, Odniel in chapter 1 comes through as the military guy, but we'll see later on in Perek Gimel in chapter 3 that he also comes through very clearly as the spiritual figure as well. Chazal make a very big deal of Odniel ben Kenaz. They say that when Moshe died, there were many, many days of mourning. It was, I think, 30 days. And during those days of mourning, it was a very traumatic time for the Jewish people, and they forgot a lot of the Torah about that. A lot of the oral law was forgotten, and Odniel ben Kenaz restored those halachot, whatever that means. And there's a lot of Talmudic explanation on that particular point. So he certainly had the credentials, Talmudically, halachically, whatever word you want to use, spiritually, and at the same time, we already get introduced to him in the sense of a military leader. So that's point number one that I wanted to mention over here from chapter one. Point number two from Perek Aleph, which I just want to mention in passing, is a continuation from last week's parsha, which we read of Yisra. The question was, and the question is, what happened to the family of Yisra? Alright, where do they all go? Yisra goes home. Alright, he disappears back to wherever he Vayelech lo el atzor, we're told. He went home to his land, and we don't seem to hear from him ever again. Alright, in Bamidbar there's a reference to him again, but that's it. What happened? And if you look here in chapter 1, Pasuk Ted Zion, verse 16, Ubnei Keni Choten Moshe. Here he is again. Here he's called Keni. Keni, Rashi explains, Kana Chochma. He's a guy who acquired wisdom. Keni is the expression of Kinyan, to acquire. So the sons of Keni, Choten Moshe, the father of Moshe, in other words, the children, or in this case probably the great-grandchildren of Yisra, Olu Me'irat Marim, Et Bnei Yehuda Midbar, Yehuda Asher B'Negev Arad, They joined the Jewish people. They actually arrived as a group. The suggestion was they were kind of Bedouin. They basically traveled around. And at this point, they became, they applied to join the club. And what happens is that again, is not brought in the Pasuk, but Rashi brings this over here. And you'll see Rashi in Ted Zion. I'll just read it through very quickly. Me'irat Marim, he Yericho. They came to Jericho. שניתן להם בשנה של יריחו לאוכלה עד שיבנה בית המקדש ומי שיבנה בית הבחירה בחלקו ידלנה כדי שיהיה כל ישראל חלק בבית הבחירה. Basically there was a bit of land around Jericho just outside Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim to Yericho is very, very near, and that piece of land was a kind of it was going to be owned by everybody, but it was only going to be owned by everybody when the temple was actually going to be built, the Beit HaBechira, the base of Mikdash. And until that time, it was like an open piece of land, which the tribes decided that the descendants of Yitro would deserve to live in that place. So all of the children came, or the grandchildren, or the great-grandchildren of Yitro came. They're called the Canaanites, Kani. We're going to get somebody later on in the story of Devorah, Cheva Kani, presumably of the same group. And they lived around Ir Tamarim, the city of Dapon, which is another name which is given to Jericho. So basically, Rashi points out an interesting thing, that they stayed there and they came for a purpose. The question is, why did they go to Yericho? And Rashi, I think, says over here, if I can see this, Rashi says at the end here, "V'alchu etzel Otniel ben Kenaz," they went to spend time with Otniel. Why would they go to him? Not to learn Krav Maga. He wasn't teaching them how to fight. He was teaching them Torah. What was he doing? Who Yavetz? And he's known as Yavetz. When you look in Divrei HaYamim at the same description, you'll see that his name there is Yavetz. It's a nickname or whatever. Bamidbar Yehuda Asher Banegev Arad. Not Torah. So they went there to study Torah with Otniel ben Kenaz. So there's a very wonderful sort of literature which is built up around the children of Yitro, the family, the later family, which suggests quite dramatically that they made this tremendous push to become part of Am Yisrael, to become part of the Jewish people, and to connect in a spiritual way with what Am Yisrael stood for, the values of the Jewish people. And of course, this becomes a very great contrast. And the contrast is to the family, the other family of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is Moshe Rabbeinu on his father-in-law's side. All right? In other words, his wife's side, basically. What happens to Moshe Rabbeinu on his side? And if you, and again, I don't want to shock you if you've never seen this before, but if you turn to chapter, I think it's chapter 16, chapter 17, excuse me, and you'll see a story there, and I'm not going to go through the whole story, of something called Pesel Micha, a story of idolatry, which in itself was a pretty terrible sort of event in its own right. And obviously, when we get there, we'll deal with it in a bit more detail. You'll see then, again, I haven't got, can't lay my hands on the posse. This always happens when you're looking for something quickly, and I couldn't lay my hands on it before. There is a reference here to this, to the leader of the rebellion. And the leader of the rebellion was somebody called Jonathan. And who was this Jonathan? And it turns out that, and again, I'm looking here for the pasuk where it gives us his name. And if somebody can find it, I'd be very grateful. But if not, then we'll look for it. We'll find it for next week. I just did not have time to look for this. Is it?
Levi.
Ben Gershon. But he actually says in the pasuk, Yonatan Ben Gershon Ben, and he says Menashe. Doesn't say Moshe. And the nun, I wanted to show you, the nun is written in small print.
Pasuk Lamed.
Is it Pasuk Lamed of chapter? Of Yudchet. Okay, that's why I can't. I'm still working my way through 17. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much. It's Pasuk Lamed of chapter 18. The Yakimu Lahem B'nei Danet Apasel. They established this image. The Yonatan Ben Gershon Ben. And look at the word Menashe. It's either the nun is small in this Kumish, in this Sefer, the nun is raised. Because it actually is Moshe. It's Moshe's grandson. Moshe's grandson ended up leading a rebellion, an idolatrous rebellion against God. It's remarkable. So again, it just blows the mind. This guy, Yonatan, comes up again later on, in Sefer Melachim, chapter 13. There's a very strange story over there with two Leviim, and one of the Leviim turns out to be Yonatan ben Gershon ben, same guy again, ben Moshe, ben Menashe. Okay, and this nun is to protect the identity, I suppose, of Moshe. We're not so excited about the fact that the Einikel, the Rebbe Einikel here, was not so great. On the contrary, he's a guy who basically went off the derech as far as that was concerned. A lot to say about the mishpacha of Moshe Rabbeinu in relation to his wife's family, which set such an incredible example to become closer to Hashem in so many ways. The family of Moshe on his side seems to move away. Certainly, the grandson, this Yonatan, is an example. We don't know much about the rest of the family, but this one is a very striking example of somebody went the other way. The bottom line of all of this is, I suppose it's hit and miss when it comes to these things. You know, if Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't quite get it right in so many ways, one wonders, how we ever get it right. But I suppose the answer is, it's tefillah, it's education, there's a whole bunch of factors here which, again, when we get to this, maybe we'll talk about it in a bit more detail, what exactly happened with this Yonatan. So, again, back to chapter 1. Sorry, I'm moving around the Sefer, but I just wanted to point that out. So Perek Aleph basically gives us, again, a lot of the continuation of what was going on, trying to push out the people in the land. But of course, by the end of Perek Aleph, you'll see things begin to go sour. Every pasuk is kind of a refrain. Pasuk of Zion, verse 27. Lo harish Manasseh Beit Shan. Manasseh did not manage to conquer Beit Shan. Look at verse 29. Ephraim lo harish et haKenani. Ephraim did not manage to conquer the Kenani Yoshe Bagaza, in a place called Gaza. Verse 30. Zebulun lo harish et Yoshe Kidron. Zebulun did not manage to conquer that part of the country. And so on and so forth. It goes on and on like this. Asher lo harish, verse 31. They didn't manage to do what they were supposed to do. The whole idea was that the Canaanite influence and all of the influences in Eretz Yisrael, which were so negative, were so idolatrous, Am Yisrael were told at the beginning, you've got to push with these people out. There's no way we can tolerate some sort of coexistence. That's why learning this is so interesting. The whole idea, coexistence works. They've got to have a wall down the middle, right? I don't think the Israeli government is far off on that particular point either. And again, what we've got over here is that Prophet Lama Gimel, Naftali lo harish et Yoshe Beit Shemesh. Okay, as you're moving up the country, it's not happening. And as you go on, it's one sort of situation after the other, which is lo harish, lo harish, lo harish. They did not succeed in driving out who they were meant to drive out. That's really chapter one. Chapter one is the continuation of the conquering, the interesting mention of the sons of the grandchildren and so forth of Yisro, which is all sort of partial by itself, and the failure of the Jewish people to do what they were what they'd begun with Yeshua, and they hadn't managed to finish by this time. The time frame, I did a bit of research on this, it turns out that from the time Yeshua came into Eretz Yisrael with the Jews till the end of what is called the period of the Zakenim, people who outlived him, the elders who were also witnesses to Matan Torah, was a period of 67 years. So we're not looking at more than two generations from Har Sinai. This situation that we're reading about here is within a very short time period after Matan Torah. We're not looking at a long period of time. What is so shocking, what is so frightening, is what already begins in chapter 2. Perek Bed, which again I hope some of you will have seen.
Wait, can I just ask you?
Yes, sure.
The fact that it mentions they weren't able to get these people out. That's a criticism?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The authorship, please you ask that, because I just want to mention one thing. The authorship of the Sefer, the tradition is that Shmuel HaNavi wrote the book, the prophet. Why would he write it? Why is it called Sefer Nevi'im? It's not prophecy. The answer is that the Nevi'im, the prophets, had really two functions. Number one, they were prophets, and number two, they were castigators. They actually gave Muslim. And here, Shmuel is without question giving a tremendous Musa to the Jewish people. Learn from your mistakes in Jewish history. Of course, why is Shmuel writing it? Because he sees that we're going into the period in his day of kingship, and he wants Am Yisrael not to make the mistakes they made with the Shoftim that they're going to have now. Kings, hopefully things are going to be different. And it's very fascinating. The nuance of the whole Sefer, certainly at the beginning, is Shmuel basically writing, and I'm sure he's crying, his tears in his eyes when he's writing. happiness. How Am Yisrael had a golden opportunity to do what they were supposed to do, and they blew it. All right, this reminds me of what Abba Eban said once about the Palestinians, that they never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. All right, that was his famous comment. And at this point in time, with Am Yisrael, you feel they're missing the opportunity to have a chance to do something, and they're failing. And it gets worse. In chapter 2, and thank you for the questions, that's sort of the point that I wanted to raise. We've got a continuation, essentially, of the deterioration of what's going on. And particularly, I just want to point out here a couple of psukim, verse 6, Vayishalach Yeshua et ha'am. What's going on in Perek Bet is a kind of review. We're going back to Yeshua as if Yeshua is still alive, or we're reporting on what Yeshua did when he finished his particular part of the conquering of Eretz Yisrael, not the complete thing, but what he started to do. He started to get the people to go and populate the areas which they were meant to populate. Those who have the red book, the Judaica one, you'll see in the back, there is a map with the actual areas which were divided by the tribes, where they had to go. And you'll see it's all nicely set out for you over here, all the various names of the Shrotim, who went where. So after certain tribes had finished what they were meant to be, what they started doing, Yeshua had already begun the process of sending them home, if that's the right word to use. I know Rabbi Yudin would be pressed with that word. Sending them home to the point where they were beginning to develop the land. They were beginning to go and work the land, because part of the deal was not just to conquer the land, but to build the land. There was this wonderful block of the Eretz Yisrael really blossoms in the hands of the Jewish people. And, you know, when you look at Gush Katif, I'm getting too political this evening, but I still have to mention it. You see the fact that you lose within a year what was built in 30 years was so precious, and it's now basically like Yamit. I remember Yamit because I was there about a month before it was given back. And now I imagine you don't even see anything. It's probably just covered with sand. As far as the population, the Arab population is concerned, that's, I think, the way they want to see Israel become a desert all over again. And it's outrageous. It's unacceptable. And here, Yeshua understands already from the beginning that once you've conquered certain areas, you've got to start developing the land. So have a look at verse 6. And again, I'm just going to read this psukim very briefly, and I'll show you the duff that I have to show you, which I was hoping to get through. Maybe we'll have to hold it over a bit for next time as well. Pasuk Vav in chapter 2, Vayishalach Yeshua et ha'am, he sends them away. Vayelchu b'nei Yisrael ish nachalato l'reshet et ha'aretz. Everyone now goes to inherit their part of the land. Interesting language. He sends away the Am. Vayelchu b'nei Yisrael. Am means the people. And then b'nei Yisrael is mentioned as kind of a separate name for the people. Why does he call them Am? Why does he call them here b'nei Yisrael? All right? And it's interesting, again, a lot of you, I hope, will have come across this in Torah, that Am is always used for the lower level of the nation. The word Am is when, for instance, in the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, the word Am is used to refer to the guys who got the whole story going, the Erev Ra, okay, the mixed multitude that came out with the Jews. And then you've got b'nei Yisrael. So here, we haven't got an Erev Rav anymore, as far as it goes, or they've become integrated, whatever happened to them, but that's for another time. But the Am over here, the Yelchu b'nei Yisrael, there seems to be two groups. The Am goes its way, and then b'nei Yisrael also go their way as well. Who is this referring to? We'll see in a minute. Pasuk Zayin. The Yavdu Ha'am et Hashem, Kol Yimei Yeshua. They served God all the days of Joshua. The Kol Yimei Zekeinim, and remember, we now said this was a period of, they worked it out, 67 years. Asher Herichu Yamim Achrei Yeshua. They survived Yeshua for a number of years. Asher Roed Maasei Hashem, Kol Maasei Hashem, Agadol Asher Osel Yisrael. They saw all the acts of God, the great acts of God which he had done for Israel. Ra'u, they saw. Alright, again, keep that word in mind, and we'll see something very interesting in a minute. And then Pasuk Chet, after all of that, Vayamat Yeshua Binun Eved Hashem, Yeshua died, Be'mer Esesh Shanim. And the question is again, why is it repeated over here? We know that from the end of the book of Joshua. He was 110 years old when he died, and it seems to want to repeat this for a reason. And here comes a really challenging pasuk text. Vayikberu Oto Begvul Nachalato, he was buried on the border of his inheritance, Timnat Cheres Bahar Ephraim, in this part called Timnat Cheres. Rashi explains that they put an image of the sun on his grave. That's a dangerous thing to do, because sun worship was not far away, but this is what they did because of the story of the sun standing still. That was one of the things they would remember him by. On Mount Ephraim, Mitzafon Lahar Gosh, to the north of Mount Gosh. So Chazal asked the immediate question, I've never heard of Mount Gosh. Look through the whole of Eretz Israel, there's no such place. What is Mount Gosh? And they say Gosh is the concept of something which is bubbling up, like a volcano. And again, we'll see in a minute what that actually is about. There is within this little section that I just read to you, a world of analysis. And what we're going to come to grips with this evening, I hope, is the understanding of why things started to go wrong. What happened in these two parokim, essentially going into Perek Gimel, which is something, again, which we'll have to look at. I'm not going to get it done this evening, but Mr. Shem next week. The beginning of things falling apart. Am Yisrael come into Eretz Israel and it's a blast. It's unbelievable. Yericho and I and you name it, everything is going on. And they're on the crest of the wave. There's no question about it. Yeshua's with them and, all right, Moshe was the sun, Yeshua's the moon. Fine, but they still got the moon. They can still see something, right? And the influence is there and everything is happening. And all of a sudden, we're going to see within a very short period of time that the whole enterprise doesn't just slide downwards on a slippery slope in a gentle way. It goes down like that. You know, I've mentioned something. I think I mentioned to William. It's like that ride at some of the fairgrounds of the Six Flags. When you go at the top, it goes down in one shot. Takes your kiss because you know you leave your heart up there and you're down at the bottom. And this is what happens. Somebody said they go down the drain here in such a quick period of time and in such a dramatic way. We have to understand what went wrong so quickly. How could they lose that momentum? How could they lose that push that they had at the beginning? What was the issue? Or what were the issues? And we're going to see initially the issues boil down to two things. Number one is a spiritual, I suppose you'd call it materialism versus spirituality, the constant clash of Gashmus and Ruchnius. We'll deal with that maybe already today. And next time also we're going to deal with another issue which is a real shock, and that is the issue of intermarriage. There was such a problem at the beginning, they thought that they could play the game of intermarriage in a way that they could make it work to their advantage. The Jewish people thought that they could do it, and it didn't work. It actually worked absolutely against them in completely the opposite way. So we're going to come to two issues really which are not so far away from the world that we live in today. And nevertheless, it's interesting, as I always sort of point out, learning Novi or learning Tanakh, learning particularly the Sifrei Neviim at the beginning here, is really learning about our roots. This is where we come from. As much as we come from Eastern Europe or wherever our parents, grandparents came from, we also come from this as well. And it's important to appreciate that. Let me just show you this page. I'm just going to hand this out. And we'll begin to have a look at this. And I want to just point out a few comparisons if we can just pass these around. Just make sure I hold on to one. There you go. What we're going to see over here, this is again taken from the sefer I mentioned last week of the Yitzhak Levi. And as I said last week, you know, if the text is kind of off-putting, don't worry about it because we will go through it. This is the original. Okay, that one can go out. We will go through it, and really the main point of the exercise here is to get the message of what he's actually saying. And I'll just start off as follows. Listen to this. Vayokem do achachrem. A new generation arose, and this is already what we see in chapter 2. There's a new generation. situation, and problems begin. And again, if you read chapter 2 and get through to the end of Perikbet, you'll see the way that this is presented, that the problems began, the desire began, idolatry begins. Am Yisrael really, it's like an overview of the whole sefer. The chapter 2 and beginning of Perek Gimel as well, the first 6 sukkim, 7 sukkim of Perek Gimel become like an overview, becomes like a preface to the whole book. So let's see what's going on here. This is just gone off, so I want to we'll read a bit of this, and I just want to show you a bit of section A and the comparison in section B, and if we have time, if we can get over the page, we'll see how we go. Have a look at the beginning over here. This is again taken from the Sefer Reb Levi, a very wonderful teacher who passed away in Israel a number of years ago. He says, we have to work out here. In other words, what are the 3 chapters, the 2.5 chapters, essentially, at the beginning of the book? What's going on? What is happening here? He says, we've already seen the Mala previously. What's happening here? If we read through chapter 1 and chapter 2, we begin to see a tremendous downturn in the situation of the Jewish people, and he says, "No, it's horrific." And they're just beginning to be in the land of Israel, and they're already on a decline. As we just pointed out, they did not push out the Canaanites. They could have done it. Their hand was the upper hand, and nevertheless, they didn't finish the job. They made covenants with the nations in Israel, the Samum Lamas, and they made them into tributaries. In other words, they made the people subservient. You needed it's so similar to what happened in Israel in 1948. The idea that the Arab population that stayed they tried to integrate them. They tried to a lot of people used Arabs for work, for building work and stuff like that. Very similar. And they allowed them to continue their idol worship, which was so despicable to us. Even when there's a rebuke, as you'll read in the end of I think it's in Perek Aleph that we read, the whole rebuke was very short-lived. That does not seem to be a concept that people were taking notice of what was going to be essentially in the future. People went into Eretz Israel, and it is as if they completely blanked out everything that they were told prior to going into Israel. You know, if you look just down the page, you've got the Pesukim from Moshe Rabbeinu, from Devarim, that small paragraph with 2 lines. Ki tolid banim ubnei banim, we read it on Tisha B'Av. When you have children and grandchildren, shantem ba'aretz, you'll be in the land. Mishchatem, and if you go and you become corrupt, vasitem peso t'menako, vasitem harab in Eshem lekech alachiso, and then you'll do things to anger God. And then he says that what will happen is that you are warned, the Torah warns you, that you you'll break the covenant of Hashem, and you'll be punished. Yotzat Hashemayim v'lo yematar, etc. We know the psukim, many of them are very well known to us. So in the first paragraph, section A over here, what Rav Levi is pointing out so clearly is the big question which we're trying to deal with: how did it go wrong so quickly? Now, interestingly, what he does in section B is compare what we just read, Pasuk Vav, through to Pasuk Yud, what we read in chapter 2, with the end of Sefer Yoshua. At the end of Sefer Yoshua, there is a similar kind of epitaph to the life of Yoshua, but there's a very big difference between the two descriptions in terms of the language and the order of the verses. Now listen to this. What I call Nechama Leavitt style. She would have done this, and it's the way that, you know, you really get to the heart of what's going on. If you just sort of work the two psukim side by side, on section B, on the right hand side is Yeshua Chaf Dalet, Yeshua chapter 24, the last chapter. chapter of the book of Joshua. And on the left-hand side in the heavier print is Shoftim Bet, chapter 2 of Shoftim, which we just read. And you'll see the psukim interestingly go kind of parallel here. Pasuk Kafched of Yeshua, Veishlach Yeshua et Ha'am, Ish Nachalato. What does our pasuk say? Veishlach Yeshua et Ha'am, V'yelchu B'nei Yisrael, Ish Nachalato. Right? In Yeshua, it just talks about sending the people away. In our pasuk, written by Shmuel HaNavi, about this time period, he says Yeshua sent the people, and B'nei Yisrael went away. And of course, what is going on here is very significant. He explains over here that there is a difference between Am and B'nai Yisrael. Who are the Am? Well, we would call nowadays the Amei Ha'aretz, not the ignorant ones necessarily, but the people who work the land. Who are B'nai Yisrael? B'nai Yisrael were meant to be the more, how should we say, the more scholarly people. This is the suggestion that he brings, that Yeshua was sending away two groups of people. One group of people to go and work the land. You've got to go and develop the, what we nowadays say, the Kibbutzim, the Moshavim, and everything else. And you have the B'nai Yisrael, there's a group of people who presumably would become the Torah scholars. You needed that group of people in Eretz Yisrael. Now, what happened is very frightening, because you'll see that by the time that we finish over here, both the Am and B'nai Yisrael, instead of the Am alone working the land and B'nai Yisrael doing what they're supposed to do, everybody got involved in working the land. Everybody became so overwhelmed with the material development of Eretz Yisrael that the spiritual component, which was meant to be there, was pushed to one side. It became, as it were, secondary. Look what it says in Pasuk Zion over here on the Shoftim side. We just read it. The Yavdu Ha'am Et Hashem Kol Yimei Yeshua. It's telling us that in the days of Yeshua, everybody served God. The implication is that once Yeshua died, wasn't so straightforward anymore. Yeah. That you did not have the people sort of following Hashem so easily. The Chol Yimei Hazakenim Asher Yichyu Menach Yeshua Asher Roed Maaseh Hashem Agadol Asher Asa Lisrael. They saw what Hashem had done to Yisrael. Why is Ra'u? Remember, I pointed out to you, Ra'u, they saw it. Look at the Yeshua side of the Pasuk Lamed Aleph. The last verse that is quoted, "V'yavod Yisrael et Hashem, Kol Yimei Yeshua." Similar idea that they served God all the days of Yeshua, and it says Yisrael, not referring to the Am, but the whole of the Jewish people. The Kol Yimei Zekeinim Asher Rich Yamim Achri Yeshua, Asher. What's the next word? It's classic. Not Ra'u, Asher Yadu. They knew God. It wasn't that they'd seen the work of God, they knew. Right? Reb Soloveitcher's got a very wonderful analysis in the Tshuva lectures about the difference between Riyah and Yediyah. It was a change from one generation to the next. The generation of Yeshua knew God. The generation after Yeshua, Ra'u. You say about them, they saw, but how do you put it? You say they did not internalize it. They had not in any way come to the level of that previous generation. It became superficial for them. Yeah.
Maybe it's referring to Asher Ra'u as the people who are still alive from the time of Yeshua. They're the ones that saw that the Am Lord
didn't even see.
So you do means they had a...
Correct. And the decline, even amongst the ones who should have been, you know, B'nai Yisrael, this suggestion that even the ones who were sort of more connected to God spiritually, it was already beginning to decline. The language is so significant, because these two paragraphs are parallel. But already you can see that there are differences. There's a Yadu in Yeshua, which has now become a Ra'u. And so on and so forth. I'm not going to go more into these comparisons, but again, you can take this home, you can look at it yourself. It's a very special thing. Look on the back of the page, and I'm going to sneak this in, and you'll see something remarkable. We spoke about Har Gash, and the rabbis, again, were very perplexed. What was the mention of Yeshua being buried in Har Gash? So look at this, it's section C on the back of the page, and it's the middle of the page. And we've got here a statement of Chazal which is absolutely frightening. When Am Yisrael are coming to the point where they're beginning to develop the land, and we're now saying the Am went to develop the land, And the minister, who should have been maybe a bit more, how should we say, less keen to get involved in growing their tomatoes. They should have been more involved in being worried about, you know, who's going to become the judges of the nation, who's going to become the deciders, the based in the Sanhedrins and everything else, learning and supporting the spiritual side of the nation. That was not happening. And what was significant over here is something really frightening. The Higiyu Adavarim, the paragraph which is right in the middle of section C, the Higiyu Adavarim Lidei Matzar Amuchuneh Befi Chazal Atzlut. The nation became so involved in preparing the land, they became lazy. And what were they lazy about? Hespedo shel Yeshua. When Yeshua died, they gave no formality to his burial whatsoever. They didn't go to Moses, they did nothing.
It's totally different with Moshe. Moshe gets like a whole big burial.
He gets the big everything. He gets the procession and the whole work. With Yeshua, zip. And listen to this. This is what is so scary. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. This is quoted from Gemara Shabbat. Kol amitatzel besbedo shel chacham. If you are lazy about giving a hesped, giving the right honor to a chacham, a wise person who passes away, ra'oi lekavrochad b'chayav, you should be buried in your lifetime. In other words, they're not very happy about it. Shenema, because it says, ra'yikberu oto b'gvur nachlato, b'tim natzecha sheba'afayim, the passage that we read, mitzafo lahagash. Melameh, what does this teach us? Sheragash aleim har lahorgam. The mountain became so upset, the mountain, nature became so upset that it wanted to kill the Jewish people who were there, who didn't do the right thing at the burials. Look at the bracket. There was no mourning for 30 days, Kamoba Moshe the Aaron as there was in Moshe and Aaron. They were totally, they ignored the death to a point where literally he was buried and I suppose the family was there and that was it. It was like a private funeral with absolutely no involvement of the nation. It's unbelievable. Amar Rav Chiya Ba'aba on Rav Yochanan, another statement of the Gemara, Kol HaMitatzel Besbeido Shel Chacham Ein HaMarech Yamin. It's not going to be a good sign for long life if you don't give proper hesped. Midah Kenegin Midah, as it were, measure for measure. Okay, I suppose, you have to look in the Gemara there. Eit Vei Rav Chiya Ba'aba Rav Yochanan V'yavdu Amet Hashem Kol Yimei Yoshua V'kol Yimei Zekeinim Asher Rich Yamin Achrei Yoshua. Seems to be that they had long life at that point. Om Alei Bavloi, you're a Babylonian, we don't know what you're talking about. Yorim Herichu Shanim Lerichu. In other words, there was not a long time after the death of Yeshua that these Zekeinim, who should have known better, actually lived. They passed away in a relatively short period of time. Unbelievable. And what's going on? Look at this next paragraph. How the Omer Shatavia Musmeh Klape Zekeinim Yechidei Sekula, the ones who should have known, the Zekeinim, the elders, Shedifet Isuk Bishuba Aris. What did they prefer to do? To grow their tomatoes. They wanted to develop the land. Below Gomlu Chesed in Yeshua. And with Yeshua, when he died, they should have been giving him Chesed. They should have done a funeral service for him. It should have been a national time of mourning. Right, Moshe was 30 days to make it 15 days. I don't know, whatever it is, just to reflect the difference. But do something. Nothing was done. Ochein heitiv anavi lizayek b'sefer shoftim. Tosif avchana zu shal dvarav shal anavi b'sefer Yeshua. Yeshua shalach adam. And then he goes in also to explain essentially what we said before about Riyah and Yidiyah. If you look at section D, you'll see Yeshev del bein Riyah and Yidiyah, as I pointed out before. Look at this last statement over here, and you'll see something very fascinating. Ala dorad, it's literally the last six or seven lines. This is what Asaf talks about in Tehillim. Okay, whoever Asaf is. They tested and they rebelled against God Most High. They did not guard his testaments, whatever the words of Hashem, presumably what it means. And they literally, what's Bogadnu? They acted treacherously against their fathers. They became like a keshet remiah, like a bow, which is, I don't know, Rashi says, she'ena zareket chetz lemakom she'amoreh chafetz. You want to shoot the arrow, and the arrow doesn't go straight. It's not true. And it doesn't go to its place. So this is what they become. They became like a bent bow. They became literally like a out of sync. Alavotam hu amesh sham, and the pasuk also says in Tehillim, lo shamu bit elokim, they do not guard the covenant of Hashem. They refused to go in his Torah. They forgot his path, his ways, and the wonders that he had shown them. It's unbelievable. What was this all about? Absolute indulgence in materialism. They were totally. And again, I don't know if I blame them in a way, because coming into Eretz Yisrael, it must have been the most exciting project, imagine. But there has to be, as it were, kind of, how should we say, they had to get their act together in the way it should have been done. It should have been done in such a way that, okay, the Am were told, go and develop the land. But the Zakenim, the Bnei Yisrael, the ones who were more responsible to develop the spiritual side of the land, they were given a task, and they also were got so involved in the material side, the gushness of what was going on, that it seems to be that they left behind spiritual values to the point, and this is what's so frightening, that when Yeshua dies, almost it's a non-event. Yeshua passed away. You know, I mean, you go to Meshayim today, that rabbi you never heard of, and there's literally posters everywhere. The whole Yerushalayim, you know, is out to at the funeral. And in those days, you would expect Yeshua, you would expect the whole of Am Yisrael to be there. Nothing. Har Ga'ash, the mountain started quaking, literally, because that's the word Ga'ash, it's to quake. It quaked because they were so negligent in what they were supposed to do. And that is a very frightening statement. It's very scary what's going on here. This element of deterioration here is really scary. I'm going to do one more thing and then we're going to be done. Yes.
Does it say why Yehoshua didn't marry this? I mean, obviously...
Yeah, what happened from his side. It doesn't look at it in those terms. It looks at it as a total letdown. He had great merits. I mean, the fact is, it doesn't make sense what was going on. The answer is that, unfortunately, this is what we're saying, that the people should have given him the right honors, and they didn't. And that was unacceptable, totally unacceptable. Because I'll put it up smooth, they said the people became lazy. All right, the whole emphasis, the whole focus was not on matters where it should have been, it was on peripheral things, which they made, as they say, needed. The Ikar became the Tafel, and Tafel became the Ikar. It's pretty scary. All right, it is frightening because, again, you know, thank God in Israel today there's a lot of focus on spiritual line. There's a lot of moves. There's really a lot of moves. I don't know what to say about that.
There's Avi's mission too.
And with Yeshua, I mean, wow, you know. I know this is like the world. The sun standing still was pretty. That was a pretty good trick. Yes.
You got to cut some slack because Moshe was paying all the
Yeshua wasn't. Yeah.
The Chachamim, the
Chachamim,
the
Kenim
at the time did not feel he was an
Israelite
king like Moshe.
Yeah, I'm not if I can. I'm gonna go with you on that. Just by looking at the Pesukim and say for Yeshua, you know, Eved Hashem, he's given some fantastic titles. All right, he's pretty much up there. He wasn't on the same bar.
Look at the shoes he's got as well.
But the shoes, agreed. But at the same time, it's almost lacking in decency of what they do. It's as simple as that. What I want to just bring to your attention, and this will give you hopefully something to think about for next time, because we're going to go to the second component. The first component we've said, spirituality versus materialism. The spirituality was lacking at this point. The Kedim were not around. Yeshua had gone. The people tribally were still conquering the land and were not doing a good job. They decided to compromise. They did not push the people out. All this is coming together. I hope you see how the picture begins to form of what was going on. And at the same time, we see that individually the sort of kavod that should have been given to somebody like Yeshua was just not there. And this, of course, is symptomatic of the Yeridat Hador. The generation had literally forfeited, had gone away from the standard that it should have been at this point in time. This is still only two or three generations after Matan Torah. What is really frightening, and I'll just read this for Sukkim with you, chapter 3 at the beginning, and here you'll see something which really blows the mind. And what is going on over here is the following. Pasuk Hey. All of this is, again, the introduction to the Sefer. Before we get into the real Shoftim, which Mr. Shem next week will start, again, we'll go back to Othniel. He's a great guy. Othniel is wonderful, and Ehud is fabulous. I'm not sure about the current Ehud, but certainly in those days, wow, what a guy. I wish he would read a bit about his namesake. Without referring to anyone in specific. Pasuk Hey. Ubnei Yisrael, Yashu Bekerev Haknani Achiti, all the favorites over here, they dwelt amongst all of them. Here comes Pasuk Vav, Vayichu et benoteihem lahem lenashim. They decided we're going to take their daughters for wives, the et benoteihem nadnu livneihem, and all Yiddish girls can go and marry those guys. Vayavdu et Elohim, and then they became, from there, a jump into idolatry. What we'll see next week, Mitzvah Hashem, is a very wonderful piece. I mentioned Dar Sofrim, the Rabinovich, and he actually explains this. He explains how this pasuk works. He explains the dangers involved. He makes a very, what I can only describe as a very up-to-date comment about the situation of intermarriage in our Jewish world today. And again, I think this is all part of the component. We're putting together bits and pieces, all coming together to show that the deterioration that took place, as amazing as it was, now that we actually look at the circumstance, the facts, it begins to make sense. It's scary. It's frightening. It's a Jewish world that again, it should have been the greatest thing that ever happened, and it loses it. It loses its direction. It loses its kivun. It loses everything that you can possibly say in such a short period of time. And of course, why I tell you all this is that when you come to the Shoftim, what the Shoftim does to regenerate the situation, that becomes something very inspiring. As bad as it gets, we get an Othniel, we get an Ehud, we'll get a Devorah. Wow, those people really can draw the situation back, can elevate it all over again, and Mitzvah Hashem will have a lot to say as and when we get to it. I would ask again, bit of homework, but if you can read Perek Gimel, we'll look at Perek Gimel in a bit more detail, Mitzvah Hashem, for next time. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.